This interview is brought to you by Panasonic Lumix G cameras for today's photographer. I'm here with Mr. Paul C. Buff. He is the founder, the CEO, the owner of the company that goes by the same name as he does, Paul C. Buff Incorporated. And if you haven't heard of them, you're probably not from this earth, but they put out some pretty cool products. Some of his product lines are Alien Bees, White Lightning, the new Einstein product that they came out with. And Paul has agreed to come on the show to just sort of, you know, give us an insider look at the company, at Paul C. Buff Incorporated, and how he comes up with some of these products that then go on to change a lot of photographers' lives. So, Paul, welcome to This Week in Photo.
Well, thanks for the invitation. Glad to be here.
It's our pleasure to have you on. Let's start with a little history. So, how did you start in this crazy world of photographic lighting and gear?
Well, the history's it's pretty straightforward yet pretty obscure, and it's probably a good model for a lot of people out there that are considering, going into different endeavors and everything. I like to think I did it the old-fashioned American way. What got me into it is I really was not all that much into photography, and in one of my several marriages, I was married to a fashion designer, and she was wanting to do, or I was wanting to do for her, fashion shots of her clothing and models and so forth. And at that point, the world in the U.S., that was about 1979 to 1980, at that point in the U.S., the lighting world consisted of Vivitar and Nikon speed lights and Speedotron, Novatron, and I guess Photogenics power packs. And very, very rarely at that point they were available in the U.S., Bowens monolights. And Bowens is one of the few companies that's older than our company. We are, by the way, we were founded in 1981 and have been active ever since. Anyhow, as a result of that experience, I couldn't find any mention of studio lighting in any of the magazine shelf magazines, and it seemed to be like you had to be an insider and be in the professional industry to even know what was going on. Then when you got to that point, the prices were astronomical, and most of the offerings consisted of very, very heavy, very low-tech power pack and head systems. And I sort of took one look at it and said, I can do better. And I do have a lot of experience before that in designing and manufacturing professional audio equipment for recording studios. So basically, I bought a Speedotron brown line system and started shooting and analyzing it, measuring, and said, basically, this thing's a dinosaur, and I can do a whole lot better. So at that point, I spent about a year developing a very basic studio flash, which was at that point called the White Lightning 130, and it was 130 watt seconds. But it was actually, there's actually quite a few of them still in use today. But basically, it was $139, and it had modeling lights, power, limited power control. It had 1/3, 2/3 in full power, and that's what got me started.
Wow. So that kicked off the product line, and then you designed that, had that thing manufactured, and how did you market it? What was the demand like when you first revealed it?
Well, I will say to all those broke people out there, at that point, I had an investment of $1,600 in this company. And I did all of the tooling myself in my garage with drill presses and handmade metal punches and so forth. And I really didn't have a strong desire to go out and find a distributor and do it the conventional way. I really don't believe in the conventional way. So at that point, I started, my first advertisements were in Shutterbug magazine. At that point, Shutterbug was like a trader's post, and it was mostly used equipment. And the ad rates were reasonable, and I figured, well, if they're buying used equipment, I'll put mine in there, and my new equipment is cheaper than most of the used equipment. So that's where I started.
Yeah.
And I did that for about 6 months, and finally a writer at let's edit that a little bit. A writer in one of the major photo magazines contacted me and wanted to review the White Lightning 130, and I said, sure. He did. I remember his name was David Brooks. I don't remember the name of the magazine. As soon as he reviewed it, and he reviewed it pretty positively, then I really started getting enough orders to call myself a business. Prior to that, I just, you know, kept the doors open. And at that point, I started getting dealer requests and I started granting them. So between 1981 and 1986, we developed with the White Lightning line, which had evolved somewhat upward to the White Lightning 5000 and White Lightning 10000, which were just slightly improved versions of the original. We ended up with about 400 dealers in the U.S., small camera stores that existed at that time that most of them no longer exist. But we still primarily sold direct to customers. And
is that the same, is that the same as today? Are you still primarily direct to customer?
No, we've changed. We're entirely direct to customer now, and I'll tell you when and how that change occurred. For the first 4 years or so of doing this, I was learning the industry. I was learning the business. I was learning what photographers wanted. I had no real contact with a lot of professionals. So in 1986, I really put a lot of development effort into a much more advanced product line called the White Lightning Ultra Series. And the White Lightning Ultra Series, in my mind, some will agree and some will disagree, but in my mind, is the forerunner of almost every monoflash that's out there. And someone looks at history, it looks at what came out at what time. Most monolights made by other manufacturers are, to some degree, a copy of the White Lightning Ultra Series. Uh-huh. At the time we did the Ultra Series, we were actually pretty fed up with dealers because dealers never carried stock. They blamed any problems on us. They told customers that, well, it's going to take weeks to get it repaired and so forth, and it really didn't. It took a day or two. So anyhow, I made the decision at that time to go 100% direct sales. And by then, we had enough satisfied customers. We had enough of a customer base where it was quite well accepted, and we've been doing that ever since.
So, Paul, you started 1981 with around $1,600, and now it's almost 2012. How big is the company now, people wise?
We try our darndest to keep it below 50 people. We're right at 50 people, and of course there are a lot of people outside the company as partners. We have an assembly plant in Kansas that does all of the robotic assembly of the circuit boards. That's one change we made along the line as we went from hand-soldered components done in-house or with home vendors, we switched over to more modern surface mount, and surface mounting can't be done by people at home with a soldering iron, so we went to a company in Kansas, and we've probably built that company. They do a tremendous amount of work for us. So right now, most all of the board assembly is done in Kansas with the robotic assembly. Then the board assemblies come back to us, and we assemble the final product and do all the testing and all the shipping and all the repair in Nashville.
Gotcha. So then let's jump from there. That's a perfect segue into design. So how do these products come into being? Do you hire some MBA product designers to come in and design the things, and then you approve them and put them out? What's your flow for getting these products from concept to the market?
I wish I could, and that is the very hardest problem that we face with the company is in 30 years of doing business, we have never been able to hire a product designer that's capable of actually designing a product. So all through our history, I have designed all of the products. I do all of the conceptual design. I do all of the analog circuitry design. We have to go out on our new products to consultants to do the microprocessor and programming and LCD display design. And I'm too old. I'm 75 years old, by the way. So I am not skilled in programming, and I really don't have the time or inclination to get into it.
Yeah.
But basically, I end up having no choice but to do all the concepts. I do all of the accessories. I do all of the CAD drawings, all of the mold drawings. And as I say, the vast majority of the electronic design, I do have a staff in-house with an old friend, Mike Morgan, who is a PhD, and he's a good engineer, but he is not capable of creating a concept and a product from start to finish. So he assists me in getting these things put together on circuit boards. I don't like circuit board drafting anymore. It's too time consuming, so forth.
Yeah.
So that's basically our flow. And then when it gets to certain areas beyond Mike's capabilities, then we go out to consultants to have the various aspects of it done.
Got it. Oh, that's great. So then let's talk a little bit about the demographic that you're going after, like the people, you know, the pricing. Well, let's start with pricing. So, you know, looking at your monolights and your products and even the light modifiers, everything seems to be much less expensive than, you know, some of the more competing products like the Profotos and all those guys of the world. How and why are you positioning like that, you know, with the lower price, and how are you able to do that?
That is an extremely important subject, and the basis of that is the direct sales. And I could spend 3 hours explaining it, but let's say I'm a conventional manufacturer like a Profoto or like anyone else that you can buy their product through B&H and other outlets like that. If their product costs them $100 to build, they have to sell it to a dealer. Let me back up. If our product costs us $100 to build, we're operating at a very high cost of goods, but we make it up by a very high volume. So typically, if we have a product that costs us $100 to build, we have about a 50% cost of goods, which is astronomical in the industry. Usually it's around 20 to 25%. But anyhow, our $100 cost gets sold for $200, and that $200 pays the the whole company, the advertising, the overhead, all the salaries, and so forth. Now, that is the direct sales model. So the $100 cost ends up costing the customer $200. If we were operated conventionally with conventional distribution, that $100 would be sold to the distributor in whatever form he might be in for the same $200, giving us the same profit margin. But the dealer would then mark that $200 price up by around 40%. And I'm not going to try to do the math right now, but you'd come up
you're able to sell cheaper because you're almost selling, you're like direct to consumer, like you said, but it's almost a wholesale kind of deal, right?
It is absolutely wholesale. We have no one is taking any portion of our profit. It all comes to us. And of course, we have to pay for that with increased advertising. We have to have a very, very elaborate customer service department, which we do. We have about 8 dedicated customers who are on the phone. I'm going to repeat that. We have about 8 customer service people who are on the phone every day. And they communicate with customers. They're very educated in what the product does and how to use it and so forth. But honestly, that is not a tremendous expense compared to the expense of passing on a 40 or 50% price increase through a dealer network. Typically, if we were to sell this product that we sell for $200, through a dealer network without going through all the math, the MSRP price would end up being about $400. The dealers would probably discount it down to about $350. And that's the primary difference, is our product, the customer pays $200 for it. The same product through a dealer network, he would likely pay $350 for it.
Which means it's within the reach for a lot of amateur photographers and people that aren't willing unable to put down gigantic sums of money for lighting, right?
It is. That's not really the intent of it. The intent of it is the model works so much better for us because we don't have accounts. We don't have accounts receivable. We're fortunate that we're all cash now. We have plenty of capital, so we don't have any accounts payable. And the main thing that is really, I think, aids to our success in this is that we are able to provide one-on-one contact with the customer. So every customer that buys our light buys it from us. If they order through the internet, they may or may not talk to us, but most of them do, and we're always available to talk to. When am I going to get this? Am I using it right? And they range from rank amateurs to ultra professionals. And going through a dealer network, you can't call a store and ask any sort of deep technical questions about a product because, honestly, they don't know much about that product.
Yeah. So is it correct that you're not selling through Amazon.com either? Everything is coming through your website?
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
Wow, that's amazing. Any plans to use Amazon in the future, or are you just going to keep the model?
No, and we're going through that and have been for several years because we're building products with a very high international demand, but we can't sell direct from the U.S. to Czechoslovakia at the same price that we sell in the U.S., yep. Obviously, because we do then have to go through exporters, duties, taxes, shipping costs, and we have to do it properly. Normally, we have to have some sort of service center there, which we don't have. So it's just really impractical for us to consider building that into the pricing, because if we were to build into our pricing enough dealer discount to allow that to happen, our U.S. price would be almost double what it is. So we're not about to give up our U.S. market share, which is very, very high. It's in the range of 60% of the entire U.S. market.
Wow. In that segmented, how is that, amateur photographers or amateurs?
No. I mean, we are basically a professional company, and we build. I would call it maybe minimalist professional equipment. We try to avoid excess bells and whistles, and functionally, our products actually are beyond the competition in most aspects technically. So our target market is everybody, and when we started in the mid 80s with the White Lightning Ultra series, our primary customer base was professionals and semi-pros and portrait studios and Madison Avenue, and largely was oriented toward professionals. But as time has gone by and as digital cameras have come out, and particularly since we came out with the Alien Bees, our market, I would say, is probably 50% amateur, 50% professional, with all gradients in between.
That's great. Now, is Alien Bees your number one seller right now?
Absolutely. And Alien Bees was, I like to say, it was the only time in my life I've actually done a business plan or a marketing plan. And in the late 90s, we had about a 25% market share in America. Photogenics had about a 25% market share. Everybody else had the other 50%. And I decided to do a grand experiment, and because things were beginning to get quite price conscious at that point. So I decided to do a grand experiment to do basically the same technology that's in a White Lightning Ultra in a lower cost package. They're Lexan, and people say cheap plastic, and believe me, Lexan is not cheap plastic. It's very expensive plastic. But basically, we did an experiment with a radical light. It comes in pink and yellow and green and the standard black. Yep. It's very much advertised toward young people, and the industry thought we were crazy when we did it. And within 6 months of when we introduced Alien Bees, they had eclipsed the White Lightning sales. Within 2 years, they were up about five times what the White Lightning sales were. And part of the reason for that is part of the Alien Bees process was to say, let's see what happens if we actually increase our cost of goods, meaning decrease our profit, for the sake of selling more. Mm-hmm. And it indeed worked sensationally, because an Alien Bee is about 20-25% cheaper than a White Lightning, but it's functionally the same. And so we did everything we could in the packaging and everything to do cost savings, but then we went ahead and let our selling price be much lower than economics would have dictated.
On a marketing standpoint, looking at it from, you know, people, I'm a big fan of marketing and looking at how people perceive things and the psychological triggers. One of the things that people key on is price, right? So if they're looking at white, say, alien bees, and it's this much money versus, say, a competing product, which is three times as expensive, that whole price perception thing's going to kick in. Even though it's functionally the same thing, they're going to say, well, that one's more expensive, so it's better. I'm going to get that one. Have you hit that a lot?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's kind of the backbone of what we do. And actually, as I say, it's not a 3-to-1 price difference when you're comparing to White Lightning. It is when you're comparing to Profotos and Elancroms and so forth. But compared to our White Lightning, it's only about a 20% savings. But that 20%, believe it or not, causes the division in sales to shift toward the product that's 20% cheaper by 6-to-1. It's incredible. It's really hard to imagine that it would be that great, but it is.
Yeah. Have you seen any softness in the market since the recession hit? Because a lot of people are saying that photographers, strangely enough, there's been an increase in the number of amateur photographers because people are getting laid off. And they're like, oh, I'm going to pursue my passion of photography now. Have you seen that?
We have seen two sides of that. Within our own company, of course, we've done a lot of new products during this recession. We have seen every year about a 20% increase in sales. At the same time, I don't have privy to the books of our competitors, but every sensation I have is that the Profotos and Elancroms and the competitors have probably had a 20% decrease every year. So the market is definitely shifting from the very high-end, very stodgy products down to the practical products such as we make.
Yeah, because when you look at that photo, in the end, no one cares, or knows what kind of light made it, just like they don't know what kind of camera made the shot, right?
No, that's right. But it's a double-edged sword because their price is so much lower than particularly the European lights. There tends to be a you get what you pay for mentality, and you know, we cannot convince them the reason the price is low is because of the direct sales. They, a good many forum posters and everything, they're just convinced if it's cheap, it must not be as good. So we deal with that. We know it's as good, and particularly with the Einstein is without question the most advanced light in the world, period, at any cost.
Well, I want to talk about that. So the Einstein is the latest release from Paul C. Buff Incorporated. So why did you make it? I mean, if Alien Bees were doing so well, what niche does the Einstein fill?
Well, you know, the secret to continuing to grow in business, I have found, is in introducing new products. And you have to be careful that you introduce effective products, you introduce products that have a high potential sales volume, and then you don't just load yourself up with 27 different models of the same thing. We absolutely have the low and mid-range of the market in America absolutely tied up. I mean, we essentially have no competitors in America. But I decided that I wanted to do basically what I referred to as the ultimate monolight. And we've had two divisions sort of in the industry, of the ultra-high end and the lights for the rest of us. In the ultra-high end, only one company, which is Broncolor or Sonar Bron, is the only company in the world that at that point had a high-end IGBT controlled system. And what the IGBT does is a dramatic departure from standard studio flash technology. It actually allows the flash tube to be shut off when it reaches the power that you want. And by doing that, unlike all other monolights and most power packs, as you reduce the power, in an IGBT flash, the flash duration gets shorter and shorter and shorter. In conventional monolights, as you reduce the power, the flash duration gets longer and longer and longer. So there are two real advantages to the IGBT control. First, that it allows extremely short flash durations. And the second advantage is if you do your processing and the circuit correctly, you can make it produce absolutely constant color regardless of its power setting. And no other conventional light can do that. And that's a point that's totally misunderstood in all the forums. Every monolight that's conventional analog control design, which includes Profoto and Allenchrom and Hensel and White Lightning and the LNBs, every single one of them, as you reduce the power, the color temperature falls also. Mm-hmm. So if you have two lights lighting a subject and one is on full power and one is a 30-second power, there's apt to be a 300 to 400 degree difference in the color temperature of the two lights.
But with and the Einstein, all the way from, I'm looking at the specs here, from 2.5 watt seconds all the way up to 640 watt seconds, it's going to maintain the same color balance?
Absolutely. And I've tested it, measured it, photographed it over and over. It's been confirmed over and over. So we gain two things. We do gain this tremendous increase in the range of power, as you said, from 2.5 watt seconds to 640. And within that range, we have two choices. We have the normal mode, which is constant color mode. So you can set it any place you want. The color does not vary at all. The flash duration still becomes shorter and shorter as you reduce the power, but not as dramatically as it does in action mode. And in action mode, we forget about color consistency, and the processor sets it for absolute minimum flash duration. So if you're stopping hummingbirds and things like that, kids can't move fast enough where the constant color mode can't keep up with them. Even the constant color mode, our flash durations go down to 1/8,000th of a second, and that is T.1. And normally, when someone states flash durations and they don't put T.1 after it, they mean T.5. The 1/8,000th of a second that we can achieve in constant color mode is equivalent to about a 25,000th of a second in T.5 times, which is what everybody publishes. They're beginning to deviate, and people are now beginning to publish T.1 because T.1 is actually the only flash duration spec that really relates to action freezing.
Yeah. Now, Paul, I'm looking at the spec page, and I'm looking at one of the screenshots of the Einstein, and this thing looks like it could launch the space shuttle. I mean, it's got screens on it. I mean, this thing looks like it is smarter than me. So it's great. So how, and it's still is $500, right? So how are you able to get all that stuff in there and still keep it at $500? I'm like leading the witness here, but this is interesting to me because I'm looking at it. And I'm thinking this should probably be like twice that. But you know, take me through what it's for and how you're able to keep it so low.
Well, again, the $500, if Allenchrom were to make this, it would sell for a minimum of $1,000. And that goes back to the direct sales equation. Secondly, I didn't want this thing to be above $500, so we allowed our profit margin to become even further eroded from what it is from the LNB simply to be able to hit that price point. When we started out, the Einsteins were costing us about 65% of what we sold them for, which is just about a break-even profit point. Over time, we have refined the circuitry, found components that do the same job for less money. IGBTs themselves, 10 years ago, were totally cost prohibitive, but they have dropped in price over the past 3 years by about 3 to 1. Yeah. So we're able to do it, and it's not easy to do. I spent 3 years developing it. Had to work with consultants, and we made a lot of engineering screw ups and had to go back and redo things and refine it, and so we're constantly refining the Einstein, and it's getting better and better, and hopefully we will reach the point that it can be even cheaper.
Wow. So the Einstein is the flagship product right now, and Alien Bees are they're the workhorse, correct? And
yeah,
White Lightnings are the ones that pave the way for both of these guys.
White Lightnings are the Cadillacs or John Deeres. They're still around. They're not discontinued. We still sell them. They're still good lights, and they're still a good value compared to competitors. But effectively, the Einstein will ultimately replace the White Lightning line.
That's wonderful. Wow. Well, Paul, what's coming next? I mean, you can't really talk about unreleased products and that sort of thing, but just give me an idea of where things might go in the world of lighting.
Well, in this conversation, we skipped a whole bunch of things that occurred in the last 3 years, and one of those things is the PLM parabolic light modifier, mm-hmm. which is a totally unique. It's not unique anymore because everybody in town has ripped it off.
That's a gigantic 86-inch umbrella, right?
Yeah, and they go down to 51-inch. There's three sizes, but basically they're not designed to function like a normal umbrella. The basic design of the PLM is to function like a satellite dish, in that it in the silver models, it projects an extremely intense, extremely narrow beam of light. So it's more like a sports reflector in its beam patterns and so forth. But yet it's gigantic. So the principle is you can put a 86-inch diameter PLM 10-14 feet from a subject and have a grid lighting effect, but it's coming from an 86-inch source, so it will cover the whole model head to foot. It falls off very rapidly after that, and its output is as much as 6 and 8 times as high as a softbox or umbrella would be. So you get the large source size that you get from a softbox or an umbrella, but you get a tremendous amount of efficiency, and that becomes really useful when you're out on the beach and things like that, fighting with the sun, and you're 25, 30 feet away from the model, and where other more conventional modifiers might only give you F4 at those distances, you can get F11, F16 outputs when you need them, and you can light objects that are very far away but still have a sufficient coverage to light the subject. It's just that you're not lighting the rest of the world.
Yeah, it's focused down, like focusing a magnifying glass, right, to burn a piece of paper.
Right.
Wow, that's great.
So we did that, and then we did fairly recently. We are the originator of the portable power supply, which is a battery and a sine wave inverter. They didn't exist until we came out with the Vagabond One in the 90s, late 90s. And since then, in the last year, we had developed the lithium Vagabond Mini. And the portable power packs that we sold before weighed on the order of 20 pounds. These weigh 3.5 pounds. They're tiny, yet they have enough power to power 3 or 4, even 5 LNBs or Einsteins or Y Lightnings, and get pretty decent battery life out of them. They can do about 500 shots at 640 watt seconds from one light, which is typically about triple the battery life that you're getting from the, I don't know all the models, but Elincom and Profoto portable battery systems. They typically only achieve about 150 full power flashes at that power level. So this thing is just tiny as can be. It's inexpensive. It's $239. The battery is instantly changeable. So if you run out of power, if you have a spare battery, you plug it in, you got another 500 shots. And the lithium technology eliminates all of the problems that the older systems and most of the older systems include the current systems from most manufacturers. They use sealed lead acid batteries, which are basically a car battery, and the power to weight ratio is incredibly different, about 5 to 1, and the SLA batteries require constant care. If you go out and you do a shoot and you discharge your battery, if you don't get right back in there and charge it up immediately within 8 hours or so, it starts sulfating. It's very, very common for people to have SLA-powered battery packs, but they forgot to recharge, and the battery is toast. It's just gone. You have to buy a new one.
They have a doorstop, right?
Yeah, you have a big, heavy doorstop, and the lithium batteries do not have that sulfating effect. So you can run that lithium battery down to zero, and put it in your house, and come back 3 months later and charge it up, and you haven't damaged it.
Wow. So we've got light modifiers. We've got portable power. What other accessories can I look forward to coming out of you guys?
In particular, I don't want to go into too much detail on this, and it's coming along fairly soon, probably within about 3 months. We have a higher powered Vagabond Lithium, which will recycle the lights about 2.5 to 3 times as fast as the Mini does. Not too much of a cost increase. It'll be somewhere generally in the probably $350 range. That's coming out pretty soon, and that's very helpful for people that are using a lot of flash power and they're needing to shoot rapidly. The Vagabond Mini will recycle an LNB 640 watt seconds in about 3 seconds. If you put two of them on there, it's about 6 seconds. If you put three of them in there, it's about 9 seconds. The Vagabond, we haven't really named it yet, that we're coming out with, will cut those cycle times in close to a third. So you'd be able to recycle 1,800 watt seconds, which now takes on the order of 10 seconds. You'd be able to do that in about 3 seconds. The life is about the same, so you still get about the same 500 shots at 640 watt seconds.
Well, Paul, this has been a pleasure and very educational. And I'm sitting here still staring at this Einstein. So you're going to see an order come in a couple minutes.
Okay. Well, the Einstein, I mean, you only partially covered it. The Einstein And again, this is all done by me. Nobody, I can't hire anybody to come up with these concepts. But the Einstein and the Cyber Commander were designed in conjunction with each other to work together. And it's extremely powerful because the Einstein not only does all of these things, and it displays on the back panel the color temperatures and the flash durations, and it's infinitely adjustable, but every parameter of that is under radio control with the Cyber Commander. And the Cyber Commander should go up in price, but it's still $179. And with the Cyber Commander, you can put as many Einsteins out there as you want, up to 16, and control, measure, modify each one of them right from your camera. And you can do them in groups. You can bracket a whole bunch of them, or you can bracket a group of them. And it also has a flash meter built into it, so you can go out and meter each light individually, go back to your camera and look at the f-stop you're getting from each light. And if you want to change the power, you don't have to calculate f-stops and watt seconds and things. If you metered f11 and you want f8 right in the Cyber Commander, you just lower it until it says F8. And you can do that with each light individually, or you could do that with the aggregate of all of the lights. So if you've got a setup and you're ready to take pictures, and again, you meter F5.6 at your camera as the aggregate of all lights. Well, you say, I want to shoot at F11. You just dial it up until it says F11. And there's no calculation. There's no going back to the lights to adjust them. So it's extremely powerful.
And that's all from camera position. Is the Cyber Commander, am I going to be able to use that with any other heads, or is it specifically for Einstein?
You can use it with other flash units, even speed lights, but you cannot adjust the power levels, and you can't do all of the things that you can do with the Einstein because they simply don't have the interface to allow it. So you can do a mixed system of say Einstein's Alien Bees and Norman lights and so forth. Well, with the Norman lights, you can put them in and out of groups. You can flash, you can meter them, but you can't adjust the power from the Cyber Commander. After you meter them, you're going to have to go to the light itself to adjust the power. And the same applies with the speed light. You can set up a group that contains three out of your five lights, and they can be speed lights and Normans and everything else. And I'll turn them off and on in groups and control them in groups, but you can only adjust the power from the buff lights.
Yeah.
And that's one interesting thing. I try to copy Apple's backwards compatibility, which they're getting a little away from lately, but the Cyber Commander will do this as far back as a 1986 White Lightning. So we, even with a 1986 White Lightning, the Cyber Commander can read the flash duration, it can read the color temperature, and it can set the power up and down, and it can do about two-thirds of the things it could do with an Einstein. There's some things with an Einstein that can't be done with the vintage lights, but the basics can be.
And 26 years of backwards compatibility is pretty good. That's pretty good.
Well, I'm a stickler about that. I mean, I'm Swiss born. My dad was a Swiss immigrant, and I've got Swiss engineering in my blood, I guess. And I just happen to have a natural talent for, one, precision electronic design, and two, I like to think I have a good genes for concepts, marketing, figuring out how customers react, and our whole company is absolutely built on the golden rule, and it's almost absolute. If you're a customer and you buy from us, you will be satisfied, or you're under no obligation. You can return the product even if you've run over it with your car, and we'll send your money back, and that extends for 60 days right now.
Wow, that's great. All right. Well, Paul, thanks a lot for taking time out of your Monday afternoon to let me pepper you with all these questions. It's been educational, and congratulations on the product line, and you've honestly, and as you know, you've changed the industry for the better, and I'm looking forward to seeing what's next out of Paul C. Buff Incorporated.
Well, I like to think that I've done that, and I try to keep my ego down. I don't consider myself an egotistical person, but I do agree with you that I have changed the industry. I've made it affordable, and fortunately for me, this has coincided at the time that everybody and his brother has a $1,000 digital SLR, and so there's a huge market that we dovetail very nicely into. And that's, I'd say, some of that is intuition and planning, and some of it is sheer luck and timing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sheer luck and timing are nothing if you don't have something to action on, right? And you guys, all three.
Well, that's right. And again, if I come off as egotistical, I will apologize because I try not to.
No, you have every right. So, all right, Paul, thank you so much.
Okay, super talk to you, and looking forward to hearing the podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, well, take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.